with the latest news, what Wall Street Journal reported, that the US B-2 bombers failed to destroy Houthis' underground missile complex with bunker buster bombs. And here is, let me show the article in Associated Press and Wall Street Journal. And Associated Press is related to the, this article is from 2024 and October 2024. The same sort of experience by the previous administration. Right now, the Trump administration is trying to do the same. What's your take, Larry, Colonel Larry Wilkerson?
Well, the first thing I'd say is the Wall Street Journal needs to check ranges and capabilities. The B-2 can strike from Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. It can strike from anywhere on the planet. It struck from there when it hit Saddam Hussein, 19-hour flight to Baghdad on the opening of the Second Gulf War, dropping 2,000-pound satellite-guided bombs on Dora Farms in expectation of assassinating Saddam Hussein. Instead, killed about 33 civilians who happened to be at Dora Farms, a really lousy operation. But the B-2 doesn't need to go to Diego Garcia. It's a shorter route, of course. But that just shows you how little these people know when they're talking about things like this. I think we've moved a lot of equipment around, and I think it is part of Trump's threat. He's threatening Tehran. This is typical Trump, in my view. I don't think he wants a war with Iran. I think he wants to put maximum pressure on them, and then he wants a deal. And he wants to hold that deal up as better than the Obama deal. No 25-year moratorium. Maybe they'll even be able to discuss ballistic missiles and other things that Iran would not permit in the first round with the JCPOA. But I think Trump wants the deal. I don't think he wants a war. I think all of this is putting pressure, or he thinks it's putting pressure on Tehran. That's a bad reading of Tehran, too, but that's another matter.
Larry, does that surprise you when they're trying to do the same that the Biden administration was doing?
Yeah. Well,
many months.
Yeah, they didn't pay attention. How the U.S. Navy has changed over the last 40 years. We went from an era in which ship tenders would come along behind, like a carrier strike group, and could reload, refuel, resupply, to the current situation where the two destroyers and the cruiser that are accompanying the Harry S. Truman carry 96, each of those vessels carry 96 missile tubes over the vertical launch system on board. And once they fire it's not like you got a shotgun and you can put a new shotgun shell in. No, they have to actually break contact and sail off to a new port to get reloaded. So even the ability of these ships to sustain combat operations is limited. And, we knew that from the Biden administration. And yet here, the Trump crew just refused to learn any lessons from that. So I do agree with Colonel Wilkerson that Trump is trying to negotiate a deal, but we did get news yesterday. The Iranians finally responded to the Trump letter. And basically, let's see, I can summarize it in a pithy conclusion. No and hell no. they completely rejected it. And so that's going to put the ball back in Trump's court. And, Trump with his thin skin is, maybe going to up the ante and follow through on his threats. That's what I'm worried about. I know that Ray McGovern believes that that's not going to happen. But, when they assemble the tools like this, and again, as Larry pointed out, putting the B-52 and B-2 on Diego Garcia, that's all for show right now. But they're there and they can strike and they can, push us into the brink of World War III.
And I would just add to that, Nima, that I think Netanyahu is bringing maximum pressure for us taking on Iran. I think he sees this as the window of opportunity. And if he lets it close without an attack occurring, he's going to be truly angry. And that anger is probably being brought to bear on Trump right now through various different means. But I would say the most meaningful talk with the Iranians is going on through the good offices in Oman and elsewhere. And that talk, as I understand it, is being handled more or less by the Vice President, Javad Zarif, who knows this situation really well. I don't know if that's true, but if it is, I tend to agree with Ray that we are looking at both sides wanting a deal more than they want war on either spectrum. And as to Larry's point about when we did the Red Sea tabletop exercise, for example, at the USIP that Trump has shut down, with AFRICOM and CENTCOM being the principal sponsors, along with state and lots of others, we looked at these ships that Larry's talking about, and we looked at Djibouti as a possible. In most cases, as Larry has intimated, you got to have cranes. You got to have shore facilities to lift these missiles up and put them in their little compartments on the ships. In some cases, you can manhandle them, but not many. It's an extremely difficult logistical exercise, and we have not thought about that hard with regard to all these expensive $2, 3, 4, 5 million missiles going after Houthi missiles or drones or whatever that cost about one tenth of that.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely ridiculous exchange of armaments.
Well, and don't forget that even the supply of those missiles, the Aegis system, is limited. You know, I think what it's called, the SM-3, may have the name wrong, but as of 2018, they only had 660 of them. So, you know, it's not like we got bulging warehouses stacked to the ceiling with all these missiles. Man, we got to use them. We're going to run out.
And name of the other aspect of that Wall Street Journal article, coming back to that, it doesn't surprise me that these bunker buster bombs didn't get the duty stock. If they are receiving any counsel whatsoever from Iran, that probably was some of it. And we found out working the AQ Khan network during the George W. Bush administration that there was a lot of liaison going on between the North Koreans and the Iranians. And what the North Koreans were teaching the Iranians, which they could have subsequently taught the Houthis, is how to go underground. And not only go underground deep enough to be undetected, but go underground deep enough to be unaffected by anything the empire had to throw at it. Hmm. And they did a very good job of that. And Iran, as you know, has some terrain that is susceptible to that kind of impregnability. North Korea is probably the best in the world at that, because we didn't even know they had tested a nuclear weapon of a small yield because of the formation of the rocks and such around the test point. The seismic center in Switzerland, I think it is, wherever it is, reported to us and gave us news that we could send sniffers up and smell the air, so to speak, and try to pick it up. But it was the second test they ran before we could confirm that they'd actually done a test, because it was so well disguised underground.
Larry, you mentioned that Iran has responded. We know that one of the main issues between the United States and Iran is the case of Houthis, Yemenis. And it seems that the United States, in its letter, asked Iran to cooperate for the case of Yemen, not to bomb Israel. But do they really believe that the Trump administration, do they really believe in equal footing? And somehow, if you want something, you have to give something. If you have to find somehow compromise and cooperation if you want to make a deal. But do you see that coming from the Trump administration? Do you see the Trump administration, as we saw it on January 20th, before coming to power, they forced Netanyahu to go after ceasefire, and right now they're just destroying everything?
Well, yeah, it's all a question of assumption and leverage. So One of the troubling assumptions the Trump administration is making, we've heard it from Steve Witkoff, we've heard it from Michael Waltz, the National Security Advisor. Trump has even intimated it, and it is that Iran's air defense system was eviscerated by the Israelis on October 27th, and therefore it's naked. We've heard General Jack Keane, you know, the crazy Jack. He's been insisting on Fox News, saying, "Oh, it's just naked. It's wide open. We need to go in there." The fact that that's the assumption the Trump administration is holding, then that those kinds of assumptions guide your actions. You know, if I tell you that, oh yeah, you can jump off the roof, it's only a 3-foot fall, and you assume that I'm telling you the truth, and then you find out, well, actually, I had trouble with distance. It turned out it was 50 feet, not 3 feet. You act on my assumption, it's going to be bad for you. And I think that the Trump administration may be tempted to act on that assumption that they can just roll in there, bomb whatever they want, and get out. And as we've seen, not just during the military operation 2003 in Iraq, throughout the history of the U.S. Air Force, going back to the Army Air Corps, the generals running that have always made grand predictions about how much air power could accomplish on the ground. And yet we've seen, whether it was in Vietnam, whether it was in Iraq, whether it's in Afghanistan, that over and over and over, the plans that we're going to roll in aircraft to just decimate, and the people on the ground are going to, oh my God, we give up, stop. Doesn't happen. What troubles me is with those assumptions, because what came out in the Al-Mayadeen just yesterday, it says, number one, Iran has affirmed it's not going to negotiate directly with the United States. Especially under a threat from the United States. It says it does not negotiate on behalf of any regional power. So it's not going to make any deals with respect to stopping the Houthis or the Hezbollah or Hamas. And it says, they said, we don't accept Trump's unrealistic conditions, and that the U.S. demands are so excessive that they cannot be entertained even hypothetically. So, that's a pretty definitive statement from the Iranian side. And they backed it up by saying, look, you attack us, then we're going to come back and we're going to attack your bases and Israel. So, we call that part of a negotiation process, but they're laying it out there. They're not playing around this time.
Larry, your take on that?
Well, I agree with Larry there. I think if we do call their bluff, as it were, we'll be very sorry we did. And I think there are a lot of players here that Larry's enumerated, some of them that were the journalists, for example, the mainstream media like the Wall Street Journal there, are not taking into account. There's so much else going on here. Than just a U.S. attack on Iran or Iran working a deal out with the U.S. or whatever. It still doesn't solve the principal problem in the Levant. The principal problem is a genocidal maniac by the name of Benjamin Netanyahu, who is destroying Israeli democracy, as Haaretz pointed out vividly the other day in an op-ed by its chief editor of the English version. And it points out every day, this morning it's pointing out again, destroying its democracy, destroying its Jewish makeup. This anti-Semitism conference they just had was a disaster. It was to invite more Smotriches from Europe than, other kinds of more liberal democratic Jews. And he's resumed, Haaretz carried 300 today, 300 he killed, half of whom were women and children. He's back on that kind of venue again, too. And he's got people leaving the IDF. He's got reservists refusing to show up in significant numbers now. he's going to cause a civil war in Syria, and I'm not even in Israel, and I'm not even sure he's killing people in Syria too. He's given the Lebanese an ultimatum. He's going to take Lebanon here very shortly. And it seems to be what he wants. There's even one speculation out of Tel Aviv, a friend of mine, a pretty smart guy, thinks that he's trying to force a civil war on Israel because he believes that he can win it. And when he's won it, he will have gotten rid of all the people that he doesn't like, doesn't want, and don't support him, and put an end to this business of having to have a judiciary that's basically decent and other portions of the Israeli so-called state, which he doesn't agree with and wants to rid himself of. So this is a much bigger problem than just Iran, but Israel is at the center of it. And I keep coming back to this proposition that I make. I don't think, other than the Congress, which is bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex and AIPAC and others too, but I don't think, other than that, it's really AIPAC that has this influence. I think it's the empire that is using Israel to do its bidding for it in the Levant. And its bidding is chaos. We want chaos because chaos serves our purpose. We want chaos in the center of Europe with Ukraine too, because it serves our purpose. And then you ask, what is our purpose? That's a very good question.
Larry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the other dynamic to throw in this is the comprehensive security agreement signed between Tehran and Moscow on January 17th. Now, it's not a classic mutual defense treaty, you know, in which the Russians don't say, if you're attacked, we're going to come defend you and we'll fight beside you. However, the one section that does deal with military response is tied to Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. And the Russians basically said, they were saying, look, if you go out and start trouble and get into a war, we're not necessarily going to come fight on your behalf. We're not going to help you. However, if you're attacked and in violation of Article 51, we will. So there's that hanging over this as well. And not just with the Russians and Chinese about a week ago, week and a half ago, just completed the 7th annual March military exercise that features China, Russia, and Iran. That kind of exercise we shouldn't dismiss as being, you know, meaningless. Because at a minimum, what it shows is there's a level of planning and cooperation taking place between Russia, China, or among Russia, China, and Iran, that friendships are developed among the different officers. They learn about each other's military capabilities. And I don't believe Russia and China are doing that just because they're bored and they have nothing better to do. And there's always, you know, at least a 12 to 18 month window of planning that goes into putting these kinds of exercises together. So I think the other thing that I don't think the Trump administration really comprehends is that this new relationship between Russia and Iran is predicated upon creating this economic corridor that runs from southern Iran up through Azerbaijan into Moscow, where Russia is no longer dependent upon the Red Sea or the Bosphorus Straits getting into the Black Sea, that they have another route, an alternative to the oceans. And again, I don't think the Trump folks are taking this into account. They are doing a silo approach. They're looking at Israel and Iran as one thing, Ukraine and Russia as a completely separate thing, Russia and China is a completely separate third thing, without understanding these things are interconnected.
They're so interconnected, Nima, that I think Larry's on to what I'm trying to draw out of other people as to what the real strategy of the group that wants to do this. Some are in the Pentagon, some are in the National Security Council, some are at state, is. And it is to do just what Larry just described. It's to bring Russia and China out in the open, allied with Iran or whatever, to where we can strike her before she grows any stronger, and we find it difficult to do so, if not impossible. And this is a crazy strategy, but I know people who believe this is going to work. And they have been fomenting the Ukraine conflict and pushing what's happening in the Levant to include allowing Israel to really go into Syria significantly now, to begin to kill people, drop bombs on Damascus and other things like that, in order to keep this going and to draw these powers in and out, if you will, and attack them. And that's what worries me, because we will get into that conventional fracas. We will start to lose badly, and then we'll have to turn to nuclear weapons. And the idea that we won't turn to nuclear weapons when we're losing badly conventionally is poppycock. We will.
Yeah.
Larry, you've mentioned the case of Iran together with China and Russia. Do you think that's missing in the reports coming from the intelligence in the United States?
Missing, man. It's, yeah, they put the picture of Putin and Xi on the side of a milk carton, okay? It's that kind of missing. If you've taken time to read the latest threat assessment, the global threat assessment from the intelligence community, it is an appalling, embarrassing piece of work. It's banal, it's sophomoric, and it is so, there's no strategic assessment at all in it. It's just, I think they just looked at last year's version and said, oh, let's just change a few words and update it here and there. They have BRICS. BRICS receives two mentions in the entire report. And those two are in the section dealing with Russia. And in one paragraph, they said, well, Russia can work with China and with the BRICS countries. And it's like, you guys not even understand that China is part of BRICS? You know, if you're going to say BRICS, I understand that you're talking about China. So it is no consideration at all to what has taken place. Now, I asked Sergei Lavrov that very question about how the United States views its use of Russia as a tool of leverage to split Russia from China and to then use Russia as a springboard to help attack China. And I, you know, basically wanted to verify that he understood that that's what they're doing, and what did he think about it. And, you know, he acknowledged that, yeah, he laughed in fact about it. Dismissed it as foolishness on the part of the Trump administration and the pundits in Washington, D.C., that they can somehow stage manage Russia and to become a tool of the United States' plan to deal with China. And, you know, the Russians are aware. I think the Chinese are aware, and they recognize that the United States is a toxic mess, and they're going to try to avoid us as much as possible.
Larry, do you feel that Putin right now is trying to, he knows that Donald Trump would be a better option to negotiate with, and he knows the importance of this new attitude on the part of the United States, but how is it going to change the Russian strategy? Is that going to change their long-term strategy in terms of the partnership between the three countries, between Iran, Russia, and among the three countries, Russia, Iran, and the United States and China?
That's a good question. I'm watching Russia very carefully in terms of history. Go back to Catherine's court when a 14-year-old John Quincy Adams was there and delivering better reports on Russia than probably our diplomats were doing. And then later, as a grown man, of course, becomes our ambassador to Alexander court. And it was said at that time that the United States, Washington, knew more about Napoleon's movements than any capital in Europe because of his presence at Alexander's court. You might recall that Alexander was an ally of Napoleon, that he was an enemy, that he was an ally, and so forth. And Russia has this decision to make. At least since Catherine's time, they've tried to make it positively toward Europe. Which way do we go? Do we go neutral and not worry about anything? Do we go east and worry about that monster sitting on our border out there south of Vladivostok? Or do we go west to Europe, which is where we want to go? Catherine's court, of course, spoke French. That was the diplomatic language of her court. Russia has tried two or three times to get into Europe and each time been rebuffed by Europe. This latest time, I think, is the worst and the most bitter. And it did not have to happen. I served in an administration that was ready to accept Russia in for even observer status at NATO and maybe go further than that. We screwed that completely when Bill Clinton became president. He was an idiot, and he's the one who started the expansion of NATO and so forth. All to say, Russia doesn't want to go east. It wants to come west. And what we've done under the Biden administration, and I was hoping Trump would reverse this, and there's still a little bit of hope, is to reverse that and to get Russia back into Europe, even into a new European security architecture that would include them prominently. Do away with the CSTO. Do away with NATO. Let's have a new security architecture where we have 750 plus million Europeans and Russians from the Urals in anyway, working together. We've screwed that. We've screwed that completely. So what, and I come back to the strategic question, what is Putin's decision going to ultimately be? Will Trump work a deal, a rapprochement, if you will, that over the head of Europe, because it's going to have to be initially over the head of Europe probably, that attracts Russia, accepts Russia, and brings Russia into a new European security architecture, and thus brings them away from China? Or will he force Putin to make a decision? I don't think sitting in the middle is a choice anymore. Will he force Putin to go the other way, as reluctant as he might be to, especially in a wartime alliance? But he will if he has to, because he's the ultimate pragmatist. And if he does, then we've got what we want again. We only a much more massive enemy and a much more deep potential to go nuclear, because we're going to lose. We're going to lose. But there are people in the Pentagon and there are people in the government who see that as inevitable. Hell, there's a realist called John Mearsheimer who sees that as inevitable. We are going to fight China. John will sit at the lunch table with you and tell you we are going to have a war with China. And then when you ask him who's going to win, it gets a little difficult to go further. And I think it's going to go nuclear. And I would rather not see that.
Larry, do you see the case of Iran similar to that one of Russia? Or you find it totally different from what Colonel said?
Well, Iran is tied up in our national security mythology. We've created Iran as this great monster, this great, you know, the number one threat of terrorism in the world. Now, when it comes to issues like terrorism, I'm sort of old school. I like to go back and say, okay, show me what the incidents were, show me how many attacks there were, show me what the nature of the targets are. And when you do that kind of analysis with respect to Iran, you find out not only is Iran not the number one sponsor of terrorism, Iran has been one of the leaders in fighting Islamic extremism. And people go, wait a second, what the hell are you talking about? Well, all I can do is draw up on the State Department's annual report. It used to be called Patterns of Global Terrorism back in my day. Now I think they call it Country Reports on Terrorism. And just go back through the last 12, 15 years. They didn't start listing the top 10 groups being most active. You know, they used to, and then they stopped. But it started up about 2015. And, you know, really over the last 10 years, when you look at the top 10 most active terrorist groups, they're all Sunni. None of them were Shia. And none of them were directly sponsored by Iran or indirectly sponsored by Iran. But you'll find between, 2017 up until 2023, one of the most active groups was called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. Oh, our new best friend in Syria. Yeah, there was an actual guy that was actually killing people, actually committing terrorist attacks, and actually getting recorded by the State Department. So this demonization of Iran ignores what I'll call our complicated history. You know, you go back to January, February of 1981, Ronald Reagan's freshly in office, and in comes the CIA with the Israelis in tow saying, hey, Mr. President, can we sell weapons to Iran? And remember, this is at the time when the U.S. hostages had just been released out of Iran. And Reagan goes, okay. So, you know, United States began arming Iran. And then, you know, we were helping arm both Iran and Iraq so they'd fight each other. You know, saw that, you know, our Machiavellian plot. But Iran normally in its targeting, we point to the attacks on the Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon in 83, as well as the attack of the U.S. Embassy is. See, they're terrorists. They're attacking us. They were attacking basically military targets because we, the United States, were sending shells from battleships into the Bekaa Valley, killing Shia families, civilians. So whenever over time, Iran has had a pretty actually clear-eyed vision of what they're doing when they carry out violence against us, we're the ones that are confused.
I got to deepen and echo that 100%. I used to sit there and look at the State Sponsors of Terrorism report as it came across my desk and call my contact in the White House and say, how come you got Cuba on here? How can Cuba have sponsored a terrorism act? Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then I would say, how come you got Iran on here? And I would, not quite as deeply as Larry did, but I'd go into some of that. Well, you know what politics dictate. Mm-hmm. A largely political report in many respects.
Yeah.